Paper 29, section 4 now, which is on old single column, page 324. All right, let's see. I guess we'll just say that we're, you know, going to have some fun. The master physical controller section has got all kinds of fun little tidbits in there. Several of them that are quite mysterious. Look to me for those who are unpacking at a level a few centuries now, but nonetheless, a lot of it is immediately tangible when you're just trying to get into the basic picture and not get into the precise details of what each of the master physical controllers might be up to in relative to energy. I think we'll just, you know, jump right in. You'll see, you know, they basically set the stage right away in the first paragraph. So, you know, just we're moving down the chain of the power beings here. So now we're going to get the rubber meeting the road.
For the master physical controllers, these beings are the mobile subordinates of the supreme power centers. The physical controllers are endowed with capabilities of individuality, metamorphosis of such a nature that they can engage in a remarkable variety of auto-transport, being able to traverse local space at velocities approaching the flight of solitary messengers. But like all other space traversers, they require the assistance of both their fellows and certain other types of beings in overcoming the action of gravity and the resistance of inertia in departing from a material sphere.
All right. There's often going to be a lot of things that we can delve into. So let's just start picking our way through it here a little bit at a time. Yeah, so I avoided the one intro I could have given because it's that first sentence, you know, just that specific reminder that we had... we just got through unpacking the all the different centers, and that we discovered that the fundamental picture there was that you had the seven supreme power directors on Paradise as source, and then you have this whole hierarchical center, so that together they're source and center. Obviously, as a center, by and large, are going to be fixed. And so that's, you know, the most immediate distinction as you drop down to this level is they're mobile. You know, these subordinates of the centers are mobile. And they need to get here, there, and everywhere, you know, as fast as possible. So they're basically, you know, pegging the needle up there with the solitary messengers. In other words, they have a minimum relationship to finite space and time. They can't be completely transcendent, or wouldn't be much use in engaging finite, you know, physical things like they are. But you know, the way they say that individual, you know, metamorphosis, you know, such capabilities of individual metamorphosis, it sounds like perhaps, you know, they can bring themselves down into more immediate contact, but then they can back off, you know, to the point where they're almost transcendent, like a solitary messenger, and, you know, and so they can have a very high effective speed relative to finite things. And again, remember, we've talked about this, don't think of this as that there's somehow beings, you know, be they transport seraphim or these beings or solitary messengers or whatever, that somehow you have beings that are literally going through finite space and time in finite projectile fashion. You know, these beings are very much transcendent, so that you know, they're not going to be colliding with each other in any way, because, you know, like two things that are totally down in the finite would. They're just, they have, you know, just this sort of finger that's dipped in relationship. Basically that shadow in the finite, you know, two shadows can pass right through each other. Because they're really moving in absonite space almost totally, there's plenty of volume there for them to be nowhere near each other, even if the shadows that they cast are basically on top of each other. So, just always keep that in mind that when we're talking about these sorts of issues, that it's very important to bring in the transcendental space of the absonite. You know, that a lot of this stuff is actually sort of more in, you know, and there's just a projection that's down in the finite. Okay, so there's all that. Even though we'll bring it up a little bit more down the road, let's just use this opportunity to flesh this out a little bit. When they talk about action of gravity and the resistance of inertia. Oh, maybe just one little thing to note in passing there. But like all other space traversers, they require the assistance of both their fellows and certain other types of beings. Okay, so those are, you don't know who those are. You'll see when we get a little bit later, you can kind of speculate the analog, an analogy to what they are. But they're probably, beings that are tied to the force organizers. There's a whole bunch of beings that you kind of see alluded to between the lines here that are probably the assistants of the force organizers. They probably have some vast regime of unrevealed beings. I'll pick that up later on, the detail of that. But the point is that you have gravity and inertia. So they're reminding you that this semi-material nature is very much in play. They're very vast and they're semi-material. So they have to deal with gravity and inertia in a quite definitive way. However, if you remember when you're talking about, like if you go to paper 39 and you read about the seraphic transports, even when you're talking about beings that we think of as spiritual beings, they very much have to contend with a literal relationship with individuality, with physical gravity and inertia. And it reminds you that, even if it's a being that you think of as being quite spiritual, they're not pure spiritual. Now, purely spirit energy beings, there's individuality energy, there's material energy, physical energy as part of their energy nature, of their form. And so that is in relationship to the Isle of Paradise and gravity and inertia. Now, also you got to remember, don't think, when you're talking about overcoming these issues, don't think in linear gravity terms or in Newtonian gravity terms and the kind of gravity that we're used to thinking about. You need to think about more fundamentally that the mass itself of an object with mass, or like we're seeing here, more in general, anything that has an individuality nature, it's not purely unity, has a nature that is a motion, that is in relationship to other motions. In particular, when you're talking about an object like the Earth that you want to leave, Fundamentally, what mass is an inward scalar motion. It's a universe of motion, not a universe of matter. Everything's a motion. And a mass is a motion. Gravity is the phenomenon where something is brought into two things are brought into relationship with each other, allowing you to see that motion indirectly. You know, if I put a test particle near the Earth, it will move towards the Earth. It will move inward towards that centrally focused fact. Okay, that motion is there, not as a field, but it's just that's what the Earth is an inward motion. And so things in relationship to it will, you know, two inward motions will move towards each other. They will gravitate towards each other. That's fundamentally what gravity is the motion that is the objects. And here they're just reminding you that sort of, mass-like inertia is, you know, is in general, all physical energy has a motion quality that's in relationship to the motion that is the body that you're going to be leaving from. So they have to, these power beings, have to negate that some. They aren't, you know, so this is where it's very important to not think in linear gravity terms. It's not like the Earth is pulling down in this simple Newtonian linear gravity-like sense, and they're just going to apply an equal and opposite force sort of a thing. There's no, forget about that whole force model.
It's not like a rocket ship.
In a universe of motion, you don't have that sort of force model anymore of understanding things. They're just going to, they have an anti-gravity nature, basically absolute gravity nature. Their presence is an outward scalar motion. It partly negates that inward scalar motion. And so there's just less inwardness that has to be dealt with in their presence. For instance, up in paper 41, they tell you that the mass of our sun is actually less than we think, is actually more than we think it is. Mass of our sun is actually more than we think it is, because you have these master physical controllers present here in the solar system, and they're an outward scalar motion, negating some of the inward scalar motion of this that is the sun, of the sun. You know, there literally is the sun. And so when we look at how much inward scalar motion, how much gravity the sun, you know, we deduce, well, that would imply it has this much mass. Well, see, some of that inward motion has been negated by their presence. So that's why they tell you in 41, it's actually more massive than you think it is, because you don't know that there's this anti-gravity presence, okay, in the solar system from the master physical controllers. And so, see, it's like, so when they talk about resistance to inertia, and that action of gravity. See, it's all about mass and this motion. You're doing things that are going to negate that, you know. And it's in this transcendent sense where even you are literally able. They are able to negate even the absolute gravity of the aisle, which manifests like in Newtonian gravity is the magnitude of those m's. You know, like if you're thinking about the Earth and the Sun, and those are the two m's, and m times m divided by the radius squared to figure out, you know, what the relationship is. Their presence is like reducing that mass, making just less of that footprint of absolute gravity manifest. And one second, because they literally have a super absolute nature that's coming down from the infinite spirit. The infinite spirit is super absolute. The third source and center as the conjoint actor is the absolute mind. Okay, that's absolute. But a lot of things about the third source and center are super absolute. They're co-infinite. And when the third source and center bequeaths that nature down to one of these beings in its hierarchy, you know, like one of these master physical controllers, they have a super absolute nature. They're higher than the aisle in nature. Okay, and so they can literally negate some of that absolute gravity, you know, effectively just negating the effectiveness of the mass of that object, like, say, the Earth. How effective the Earth is in keeping everything where it is when it would like to get away. Okay.
So are you talking about everything's in motion? Are you referring, like, you know, so the automaton, which is spherical, is in motion all the time? So
No. Nothing is in motion.
Or motion.
Is a motion. Like they tell you in paper 42, the automaton has only three properties. All three are motions. Okay? It is a motion. It's not something that's in motion. An automaton has no mass, has no charge, you know, no nothing like that.
So,
it just
right,
has motion.
Got three properties. One is clustering. The other one is, you know,
right,
the fact
you know,
that it spins in a sphere.
Like that. You know, what's called, you know, an axial-like revolution.
Like right.
In other words, it has a motion that manifests as a closed expression.
But it's not something you can touch, for a better word. It's not a material thing, but it is and it isn't.
Well, see, that's what you're trying to really recognize is that when I'm touching the arm of this couch.
Okay.
What's really going on there is not an interaction between two masses, because mass is a motion. Charge is a motion. Everything, all interactions that we think of as something static bumping into something static, there is no such thing. Our God is a living God, and He's the first source and center of all things. Everything that comes from God is inherently dynamic, has no stasis aspect to it at all. So there's not two static things that bump into each other. There is no such thing. You actually have two motions that are in relationship. And the mind-bendingness of that is called revelation. You know? We don't want to go too far afield into physics. I don't want to get too much into physics. But when you develop a physics that conforms with the revelation, this is what you have. You have the recognition that just like they tell you that you have this respiration of space, and since everything is in space, all these motions that are things are motions in that space, everything has this outward motion, but it's not an outward vectorial motion. There isn't some special spot in the master universe, like, say, the center of Havona or something, that everything is flying away from.
Let me do a quick question.
Okay.
Right there.
Okay.
Are you talking about this from a human perspective, or from a perspective of looking at it from a totally different way than I would look at it normally. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, so it's hard for me personally to relate
right.
or put a relativity right. to what you're talking about.
Right. It's taken me I probably started on this in about 1985. I've been thinking about it hundreds of hours every week.
But does everybody else get it?
Everybody? No. Well, a lot of people in here get it because they've heard me talk about this.
But I mean, you still
a lot.
Understand it. Okay.
Well, you're not going to understand it when I'm talking about it right away. That's impossible because it's a very different than anything you've ever thought before. But I'm going to try to just motivate it a little bit before we move on. And the way you can do that is, if for no other reason because we believe in the Big Bang, you know, scientifically these days, there is this basic notion that I'm talking about in that theory, even though the theory is false, it has this basic idea in it of things moving in a non-vectorial fashion, where you don't describe their motion actually as a vector, you know, a line segment with an arrowhead on it, you know, so that it has a certain magnitude and a certain direction. There isn't a special spot in the universe that everything is flying away from, like someone lit a fuse and a bomb went off and the projectiles are just streaming out. It doesn't matter where you go in the master universe. If you look in front of you, everything is moving away from that point. And if you go over here and look, everything is moving away from that point. Everything is moving away from every point. It's not a vectorial motion, it's a scalar motion. It has no vectorial direction. It only has a sign, positive or negative. It's right now, in the respiration, it's an outward scalar motion. Come around and recognize that the motion fundamentally that is what we call mass and its gravity, its manifestation as a motion, is just the opposite of that. Negate the sign. It's an inward scalar motion. That's one reason why, even though everything is expanding out, you can still get galaxy clusters. Things can still clump because they have enough inward motion to overcome the outward motion of the respiration right now, and they can still be clumped together. Okay, and just bring that down to more of a microscopic scale, a more human-sized scale anyway, that's fundamentally what the Earth, when you're in relationship to the Earth, you're in relationship to inwardness. In the same sense that if you think about the photons leaving that light bulb there, they're just going outward because they're actually like marker dots on the force charge of space, which is this outward motion. Fundamentally, that's what you have when you look at the lowest levels. You don't have vectorial motion. You have this scalar thing. Like, for instance, the mass of an object has no arrow on top of it. Isn't mass in this direction? It's a scalar number. That mass of an object is giving you the magnitude of the inward motion. Okay. So what they're doing is when they say they have anti-gravity, anti-absolute gravity, they have an outward motion nature. The kind of stuff that they are is outward. So if they are encompassing a region, that whole region is subjected to outwardness that it normally doesn't have. Like right now, in a sense, they're kind of adding to the outward respiration. In localized regions, instead of being universal, like the respiration is, their presence in our solar system gives an additional outwardness to everything here. So the sun would like everything to be very inward. It has an inwardness that it's trying to impose on everything in relationship, but their presence is an outward, and so things don't go as inward relative to the sun as they normally would because they're negating part of that inwardness.
If it weren't for this phenomenon of the effective mass of the sun being less than it actually is, the Earth would be drawn closer to the sun. Is that
right? You'd alter the orbits and things, or if you think about sending a spaceship way out, a spacecraft way out, where it starts to get outside of their presence, you'll notice the sun pulling on you more than it used to. And you'll think something really weird is going on. But see, you've just gotten out of their presence a bit, and so now you feel a greater inward acceleration than you did before. Because you're now, the inwardness is raw now. It's not being masked by their outwardness anymore. That it has a boundary. They literally are beings with a presence. Okay? And when you're going through the early formation of the solar system description, and you get to that spot where they tell you that it was, the solar system was given a name, Monmasha, mother place of man, that's literally when they establish this cocoon of space, their presence, that so that what's inside is different than what's outside in many different ways. It's not just in this anti-gravity presence, but that's one of the things. There's a cocoon of space that has a boundary that we could send imagine sending a spacecraft to the other side of and sensing.
Today you're talking about master physical controllers, right?
Yeah, the master physical controllers, yeah. Okay? So anyway, to make a Okay, that's right. Yeah, I forgot you had a question.
Is scalar motion something analogous to what's happening on the surface of a balloon as it fills with air?
Right, sure. You know, you can picture that. You know, if you put marker dots on a balloon and blow it up, you know, if you look at one spot on the balloon, all the other spots seem to be moving away from it. But you can go to a different spot, then that spot it seems to be moving.
That's
good. Right. Yeah, it's in a two-dimensional, space. But yeah, same idea. That the one they always use for a three-dimensional is picturing a raisin cake, rising in the oven. And, if you stand on one of the raisins, and look at all the other raisins around you, they're all moving away from you. But it's not because you picked a special raisin. You could stand on any raisin and all the other raisins would be moving away from you. Okay. Those are analogies that'll get you to appreciate it. But to think, to totally let go of any, to recognize that the motion that you're experiencing in the finite isn't literally in the finite. It's transfinite, projected into the finite. For instance, it may very well be a vectorial motion in the three dimensions of the absentite. You've got something that's going, in some XYZ axis system in the absentite, as a vectorial motion, but you project that into the finite, and it's going in every direction simultaneously. For instance, if I have something that's rotating like a top about an absentite axis, if I project that absentite rotation, like that axial revolution of that automaton, if I project that top-like rotation that's about an absentite axis into the finite, I will see an object that when I play with it, it will seem like it has angular momentum, like it's rotating, but it won't have any axis. It will seem to be orbiting, rotating about every axis at the same time, including this one and this one, and this one and this one. When you project it into the finite, that one direction in the absentite goes into every direction. So the axis is in every direction in the finite. That's why when they try to understand what little things are doing, they're very mysterious. They don't seem to obey the laws of finite geometry. How can something be rotating without an axis? So therefore, they conclude they're magical. And that's quantum mechanics. The assumption that they're magical objects. Instead of, no, they can't be magical objects. If you would just think about it, there must be a transfinite space that it's actually in, and you're just seeing the projection into finite. And that's why they have all these curious behaviors. You can't assume that it's illogical, like we currently do, that it's an illogical finite thing. If in order to get the correct answer with the assumption that it's purely finite, you have to bring in magic, that's reductio ad absurdum. Therefore, the assumption that it's purely finite is false. It must have some transfinite nature. And it does. All these things that we observe in the finite are just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole absentite structure above that, a co-absolute structure all the way up, touching upon the absolute above that. And so various degrees of these or super finite, you might say in this case, these super finite phenomena are projected into the finite. Okay, like for instance, they tell you that literally, when they say that the influence of the aisle is at the center of every automaton, and all the material things like this are made out of automatons, what they're telling you is that, that sort of most basic thing about this stuff is its mass, that mass is a shadow of the Isle of Paradise cast into the finite. And the more mass something has, the bigger the shadow that the Isle is casting into the finite. Okay? If you take something like an automaton that has no mass, okay, that in the center of influence at the center of the automaton, the aisle, is not casting a very dark shadow, if you will, a very thick shadow It's casting just enough shadow that it manifests as a spherical phenomenon. It has a radius of finiteness, but not enough where it seems like that sphere is something that you can really poke like a billiard ball. It has no mass, it has no charge, it doesn't have anything that seems like a little more substantive. And yet, you know, but see again, the reason it's spherical is because the Isle of Paradise is, you know, is not absonite, not even co-absolute, it's absolute, absolutely transcendent. So it has no dimensionality when its influence is expressed in the finite. So it has, if it expresses an influence, it has to be perfectly spherical. It can't have any bias of, you know, football shape or something like that. So, for instance, you know, the very fact that, you know, that the master universe is not spherical, that it has all this structure, you know, elliptical and flattened and all that, you know, that's, the Isle can't do that by itself. That's why they tell you there's dark gravity bodies. It's the Isle through the dark gravity bodies that can give you structure that's not spherical, like elliptical and planar and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's a reflection of that absolute gravity coming through kind of an absonite lens of the dark gravity bodies and expressing into the finite. Okay. Okay. We went kind of for a field there, but
really.
But anyway, that's okay. That
helps a lot.
There's a whole. I mean, there's a
Still confused.
You have to. In order to actually get to a logical physics, it doesn't have to invoke magic like all 20th century theories do. You have to go all the way back to the beginning and recognize that you need some radically different initial assumptions that. You maybe could begin to suspect without the revelation, but you won't be able to get very far without the help of the revelation. They're going to be revelational ideas. They're not going to be anything that you can get on your own. Remember how they tell you that without revelation, it's impossible for you to form a self-consistent cosmology. You can get the first inklings, perhaps, if you've really taken delight in cultivating. You know, some objective intuition, but you'll never complete the picture. And if you do, it's going to be so different than anything you ever imagined. And fundamentally, what it's going to be is like we're talking about here when you start talking about scalar and stuff like that. It's not going to be a father-like physics theory anymore. It's not going to, remember, the father relates only to the individual. The father is this binary relationship phenomenon. You know, he does it an infinite number of times simultaneously, but any particular relationship is only one to one. It's not one to two or one to three or anything like that. It's one to one. You know, all of our physics is like that. You know, you have two masses in GMM over R squared in Newton's law. Everything is a two-body problem. It's a father-like theory. It's an interaction. It's a mere binary relationship. We have no theories that are literally systems that are more holistic, more mother-like. But actually, almost everything is very holistic. And that's why all of our theories, especially when they get down to the fundamental and try to carry that simple two-body problem all the way down and understand, you know, atoms, say, you know, in detail, it has to go magical. Because it's fundamentally, you know, things down at that level are just not going to be simply assumable to be finite in a simple linear interaction like that. Okay, they're going to be a system. And the two things only relate to each other through the whole, through the system. You know, they don't relate directly. So they have totally different characters that seem magical to us, you know, where we're just watching the two objects. It's like they're doing things that neither of them seem to have the ability to do. You know, that's because they're not interacting with each other like you're trying to rationalize. You've got all kinds of gluons or whatever trying to interact between the two of them and explain them. They're not doing that. They're going through the hole to get to each other. So no wonder it seems magical.
It's not empty.
This distinction is vital. or in a cosmic system, the individual members, including automatons and whatnot, are not connected to each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. A cosmic system, just to say that the universe is a cosmic system, obliterates all of your fundamental physics and everything. You've got to start all over again in terms of philosophically understanding how things work. And if you do, it will twist your mind a bit to get reoriented, but all of the magic will disappear. You'll have objective physics again. You won't have magical objects anymore that do acausal things and stuff.
Okay. You
aren't
popular with other physicists, are
you? Because I don't try to be. These ideas are for those few that are ready for rugged truth. Where you're ready, where you don't have your whole sense of self-worth bonded to some, you know, doctrine, be it religious, philosophic, scientific, whatever, political, economic, whatever your doctrine might be. Okay, so that's what we've got. We've got these beings that can do all kinds of cool finite things, plus they have, you know, this secret. They've got a super absolute secret that they often are playing with in overruling the aisle some. All right, let's get some more.
The master physical controllers serve throughout the grand universe. They are directly governed from paradise by the seven supreme power directors as far as the headquarters of the super universes. From here, they are directed and distributed by the Council of Equilibrium, the high commissioners of power dispatched by the seven master spirits from the personnel of the associate master force organizers. These high commissioners are empowered to interpret the readings and registrations of the master phrandolanx, those living instruments which indicate the power pressure and the energy charge of an entire super universe.
Okay, we most likely won't get all the way to the phrandolanx tonight, but you'll pick up, you know, what they're teasing there. You know, why do they mention them right up front here? Because they mentioned these associates, or well, they call them the personnel of the associate master force organizers. Like I was pointing out, there's a whole bunch of beings that they can't tell us about that are really working on some of the really big picture stuff. And here you see it, that the directors only go so far, you know, in terms of sort of really getting into the trenches and the details. Like I said, remember, those directors, what they fundamentally, they're the source part of the source and center thing. So, you know, they direct into the center hierarchy. But now we have these other beings, these mobile beings, that are, you know, in a sense not directly plugged into that, okay? And so you have this additional direction of their mobility. In other words, someone who's got their eye on the whole big picture, not just that center hierarchy grid, that framework, but the really the big picture. So that takes these transcendental beings, you know, we don't know the names of most of them, but here you've got some unnamed transcendental beings that are working with the associate ones. So that's telling you, at least you know that these personnel are, because they're with the associates and not the primaries, they are related to that interface of the absonite to the finite. They're not way up there in the absonite, you know, which obviously they couldn't be, or how could they be directing all these beings down in the trenches, you know, the master physical controllers. So they're viewing it from sort of the upper skin of the finite, seeing the big picture, you know, and manipulating them in that big picture. And the phrandolanx are, as we'll see when we get to them, are tied to that big picture more fundamentally than some of their superiors. All right. We won't try to. There's all kinds of words that they try to play with, like power, pressure, things like that. We'll just pretty much let those be right now rather than trying to somehow analyze that and, you know, figure out precisely. The idea is just, you know, they can, they're dealing with all of these various attributes or qualities, you might say, of properties of the energy system, you know, and they use analogy words like pressure and stuff. Okay.
I couldn't tune in last week.
Mm-hmm.
But did you, you know, spend a considerable amount of time explaining?
Oh yeah.
Each individual power center is constituted in exactly 1 million units of functional control.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about that.
probably took quite a while.
Well, no, I mean, it's pretty straightforward actually. That those power centers, they have 1 million moving parts. Basically, so they have 1 million degrees of freedom because they have 1 million different things that they have to be able to lock into simultaneously. They need 1 million fingers, you know, so that they can. And the 1 million things are out in the super universes, you have dual energy systems. They tell you that the energy systems out here are dual. Well, they also tell you that fundamentally you have a tenfoldness with the physical. So if you have a dual physical thing like that, it's 10 times 10, it's 100. There's 100-foldness that you have to be able to engage. So you need 100 fingers just to engage that. However, there are 3 different phases superimposed because there's 3 dimensions of the absonite. This is coming down from the absonite. And so you have these 3 different phases overlaid on top of each other. So you have 100 times 100 times 100, 1 million different degrees of freedom. If you're going to handle all those simultaneously with all their, you know, all their independence. So that's why they need 1 million out here for 100 times 100 times 100. And then the Havona centers, they also need that 1 million because in the central universe, the physical systems are triune, not dual. So it's 10 times 10 times 10, so that's 1,000. And then each one of those Havona centers handles 1,000 absolutely unique Havona spheres. So they need 1,000 for this one, 1,000, you know, so 1,000 times 1,000, they need 1 million fingers too. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's why each
of them. Nodding her head like she understands it.
Well, it's just.
I remember reading that part about a Havona system.
Right. I mean, you don't have to understand it. I mean, I obviously don't understand any of that physics. But I can multiply. I mean, the numerology, if you will, is trivially obvious. I mean, that's why it's 1 million, because you can count how many different degrees of freedom there are. There's 1 million in both cases. So coincidentally, there's this. They work in both places. You know, obviously there's a reciprocal relation because the central universe is the pattern universe. See, so that 1,000,000-foldness in there gets reflectively reciprocated out here as a different 1,000,000-foldness, but it's really the same thing, just looked at from two different ways. Okay, but that's, you know, those sort of basic, you can usually figure out when they tell you there's 1,000 of these beings, you know, or something like that. I mean, they give you numbers like that. If you just think about it a little bit, you can usually figure it out. It's like, oh, well, there's 100 of them because there's 100 constellations, you know, or something like that. It's usually something pretty straightforward. It, you know, what the 1,000,000, you got to have thought a little bit further into the physics. You know, the fact that you have this fundamental 100-foldness, and where does it come from? Because it's 10 times 10, you know, so that's why there's 100 stable atoms, and there's 100 ultimatons in a, you know, in a particle, and, you know, that 100-foldness, see, is sort of more of the, when you apply the fundamental 10-foldness, when you apply it, it becomes 100-foldness out here, it becomes 1,000-foldness in the central universe, the applied 10. Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Okay, so, but now we're dealing with the physical controllers, which, you know, they're different. They're more specialized, and you know, so they aren't like the power centers that have, you know, that have a bit of uniformity in that 1,000,000-foldness. You know, so And they tell you, the relativists, you know, the universal sense of this writing, this tells you that, you know, even he doesn't really understand the internal nature of these master physical controllers. You know, apparently they're even more, they're a little more mysterious, a little less, more opaque, a little less transparent than the power centers. You know, they describe those power centers. You can kind of just go up and look at them and look, you know, see through them and see all the parts working and count the number of parts and, you know, and whatnot. These beings are not as, you know, easy to figure out. And so they tell you a lot of times when they're acting, it's like, wow, how did he do that? What on, you know, I wonder what's going on inside that an input turns into that output when it goes through his presence.
Yeah. And the fact that these characters are personal is kind of mind-boggling, too.
Well, of course, now we're down to a level where, yeah, I mean, the power centers are all personal, very, very personal. And but, you know, only two of the groups of the seven here that we're about to read about are personal. So they are getting more machine-like. But we'll talk about that in a minute. We're ready to go, yeah.
While the presence of the paradise deities encircles the grand universe and sweeps around the circle of eternity, the influence of any one of the seven master spirits is limited to a single super universe. There is a distinct segregation of energy and a separation of the circuits of power between each of the seven super creations. Hence, individualized control methods must and do prevail.
Just reiterating what, you know, ought to be obvious, that you know, when the master spirit is not just overseeing a distinctiveness of spirit in a particular super universe, but a distinctiveness of energy as well. You know, and so the most immediate way that this energy can be attuned to a particular super universe is back at that the beginning of that hierarchy. That you have those 14 beings, seven pairs of beings with the seven supreme power directors and the seven supreme center supervisors. You know, so there's one pair of those, one source and center pair for each super universe, so that the two together can very much attune everything that's going on below them to that particular super universe. Okay.
The master physical controllers are the direct offspring of the supreme power centers, and their numbers include the following: 1 associate power directors, 2 mechanical controllers, 3 energy transformers, 4 energy transmitters, 5 primary associators, 6 secondary dissociators, 7 the Phrandalanx and Chronaldex.
Okay, just one little thing there. So the master physical controllers are the direct offspring of the supreme power centers. Okay, remember when we were talking about the supreme power centers? So you go, oh, wait a minute here. The power centers, just all by themselves, are not creators. They're just controllers. Remember back at the beginning when we were talking about the supreme power centers, and they said that 7 supreme power directors are not able individually to reproduce themselves, but collectively and in association with the 7 master spirits, they can and do reproduce, and then parenthetically they said create, other beings like themselves. So they threw in that create, like I pointed out, because you've got creators, you've got master spirits involved in bringing the power centers into existence. So those very personal beings, you can think of as being created, that kind of reproducing, as they say. But the fact is that they use reproduce there, they're wanting you to carry that thought over to here. It's like, oh, so now really think of this as not so much creating, but procreating, like we do. The supreme power centers are procreating, they're reproducing to bring the master physical controllers into existence. You don't have a direct creator being. Now, there are a few examples scattered around in the book where it's really procreation, not creation, that's in play. Okay, like if they tell you that Gabriel, say, someone else is involved in something, it's like, oh, wait a minute, Gabriel's not a creator, and, you know, neither is who he's working with there. Oh, so those are really procreated beings, not created beings. So there's procreation on high, just like we procreate.
What about trinitization?
Well, yeah, but that, see, that that's a, you know, is more like creating.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that it's coming from the other side of the original, okay? But it's, you know, that whether it's trinitize or create, the point is it's rooted back, you know, directly in the original, one side of the original or the other. But when you get down, you have this, you know, less vertical sort of a phenomenon of trinitizing or creating, and it's this more horizontal thing of procreating. You know, that creativity is going through you. You aren't the source of it. Okay.
Just be a fly on a wall during that creation.
Right. So just, you know, there's some sort of a more of a procreative like act, you know, where they they don't produce copies of themselves. Obviously, they reproduce. You know, these beings. So in the same way that when we procreate, we don't produce copies of ourselves. We reproduce because of the way the process is set up. You don't just get clones out. Now you get this new combination of the DNA in, you know, that's being input, and you get a reproduction, not just a production of a copy. That's why we call it reproduce. Okay.
So it's the power directors and the power centers that together procreate the...
No, see, right here, see, it's just, they're just offspring of the supreme power centers, the master physical controllers. I was going back, the power centers are the power directors working with the master spirits.
Yeah, that's the dual.
That's the dual, yeah, and see, the master spirits are creators.
So is that procreation or
creation? That's creation, see, because the master spirits are creators. They're creator beings. You know, when you look at you know, the psychic circles and the sevenfold, here's the sevenfold creators. You know, master spirits are creators. Mm-hmm. But supreme power centers are controllers, not creators. See, so by themselves, they can't create, but they can procreate, and that's what they're doing here. Okay. Okay. Like I said, that's why they kind of seeded that thought. You know, and you notice that they just seeded. They didn't come in. They want you to kind of slowly put this together, but they gave you that reproduce word there before, and you know, and so now you go. So that's now you can see what they're doing. You know, instead of just saying create up there, they wanted to say reproduce up there, and then kind of change their mind and say create, because they want you, the reproduce word, to come forward to here, and you go, oh, I get it. Okay. Now you could say, well, why do they do that? Well, you know, there could be some sneaky things in play, like they know if we put those two pieces together, that will foster our relationship to truth better than if they just spoon-fed it to us, or, you know, I don't know, you can speculate. Anyway, okay, so you have these seven different reproductions of the centers into mobile versions, if you will, mobile children. And, you know, with all these differences, see, so they, hence the reproduction. If you have five kids, you know, they can be all over the map, you know, in terms of their temperament. So here you have these different children. All these different specificities, okay?
Not all of these orders are persons in the sense of possessing individual powers of choice. Especially do the last four seem to be wholly automatic and mechanical in response to the impulses of their superiors and in reaction to existing energy conditions. But though such response appears wholly mechanistic, it is not. They may seem to be automatons, but all of them disclose the differential function of intelligence.
Let's read that next one, too.
Personality is not necessarily a concomitant of mind. Mind can think even when deprived of all power of choice, as in numerous of the lower types of animals and in certain of these subordinate physical controllers. Many of these more automatic regulators of physical power are not persons in any sense of the term. They are not endowed with will and independence of decision, being wholly subservient to the mechanical perfection of design for the tasks of their allotment. Nonetheless, all of them are highly intelligent beings.
Okay, now, the fact of those two paragraphs, I think, is pretty straightforward. If there's some little specific issue, you know, go ahead and let me know. The thing that you know, why they're, you know, bringing it out so much, talking, you know, using so many words, you know, where we even had to kind of combine two paragraphs before we stopped, is because of the truth that they want you to recognize that's flowing through there, that is very relevant to understanding yourself. Okay? To begin, you know, you're going to say, use these beings, thinking about these beings, to help the better think about what you are, how you're put together. Okay? Look at the way they worded some of this. They are not endowed with will and independence of decision. And they mentioned mind can think even when deprived of all power of choice. Okay, now, you've heard me talk about the difference between choice and decision before, but let's remind ourselves. So, you know, it takes a personality to choose. Okay, that word choice is a technical word that's applied specifically to personality, spirit pattern, engaging spirit energy, and purposing it. That's technically a choice. That spirit energy, though, is above mind. But it dominates mind. It's, you know, it's connected to. So that choice is translated into a decision, a literal form in the mindal energy system. So decisions are in the mind, choice is up in the spiritual with the personality. So you have these minded beings, so the ones that aren't persons here, these minded beings, they make, you know, endless decisions. You know, they probably make, you know, a trillion decisions every second. You know, they're making endless decisions, but no choices. Okay, and they say, well, I still don't really understand it. So that's why they attempted this new way of describing it. To just use the word decision instead of choice and decision and say, well, there's decisions and then there's independent decisions. See, they are not endowed with will and independence of decision. Okay, where what that mind energy is doing is independent of antecedent energy causation. Okay, so when you think about the sad to record line, you know, it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch take delight in cultivating these qualities of courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay, we're talking about that independence here. Where personality is actually being exercised. And in that, when you think about trying to take up that challenge of having independent cosmic thinking, your first thought is, I need to try to think independently of, you know, these people out there in my outer life who want to be authority figures and want to tell me how I should do this, that, and the other thing. This is how I should play this game. This is how I should do this job at work, etc. Okay.
Sounds like my kids.
Okay. That's the first thing you think of. But that's by far the second most important thing. The most important thing, the challenge you have to take on to be independent of, can you make decisions that are independent of your adjutant mindal energy system? Okay? In that, you know, in an analogy, all these beings have, they don't have will. All they have is a lower domain of the hourglass. All they have is an what we have in an adjutant mind. That adjutant mindal self. They have a mindal self, but no will. So the decision forms in that mindal self can't have no independence. The decision forms in that mindal self are all dictated by in the initial programming of the being and the environment. Okay. So this is the way it works for us. We're born with teachable mind, adjutant mind. It's not pre-taught anything. Adjutant mind comes completely untaught from your basic individual, you know, perspective. The first thing that teaches that adjutant mind is your DNA, your nature. Your DNA teaches that adjutant mind to take on a certain form. Because in order to engage, you know, your electrochemical mechanism with mechanical mind and everything and life animation, that adjutant mind has to conform to its material foundation, its physical foundation. See, the very fact that it can't just plop down, that it has to go, okay, to, you know, I got to go like that. It's being taught as it tries to figure out how to rotate. It's being taught by that DNA. So as soon as it locks on, it's been taught something. Okay, and then you proceed to go on, and there's all kinds of nurture things besides that nature that teach it some more. Now the question is, can you form, you know, decisions in that adjutant mind that are independent of how it's being taught by nature and nurture? Do you have free will? Okay, these beings that don't aren't personalities can't do that.
Can they grow?
No. They're made perfect to start with.
Do they have wisdom?
Well, they have lots of intelligence. Mm.
So they learn from their experience?
But you know, when we think of wisdom, wisdom isn't purely subjective. Wisdom is the first, you know, when you get to the top adjutant, the seventh adjutant, now it not only has the downward interface that's subjective, but it has a top interface into objectivity and personal domain. You know, that fact that that they just are, and they're ongoingly that fact, you know, they don't even seem to accumulate in that experiential sense of wisdom. See, they have this subpersonal mind that doesn't touch that, even that lower boundary of that higher stuff. They're bubbled off from it. Now, how you would relate that directly to the adjutants, I don't know. But anyway, you know, they have everything except that last little bit of mind that would connect to spirit, and personality would then engage to it. Okay? So they're incredibly, you know, they don't just say, you know, mindal or mental, you know, they say intelligent. Okay, so they have very high, you know, minds, but subpersonal. Yeah, Joan.
You get a sense that, you know, from birth, each of your children is very different.
Right, but that's in general, temperament, not character. You know, character, character is the shape of things in the upper domain of the hourglass is a very direct result of these independent decisions. This personality pattern begin to having forms up there that are called character. Down in the lower domain, you don't have character, you just have temperament. The forms there, you know, so there's an initial temperament that's dictated by your DNA, by your nature. And then there's a modification of that temperament because of nurture, because of the environment, interaction with otherness. Okay? And by and large, when people talk about the personality of someone, they're talking about their temperament. I mean, like I tried to point out recently, I mean, one of the simplest little thought experiments that you can take is, you know, the relators tell you point blank, from a personality viewpoint, spirit substance is solid and matter is very ethereal, okay, very thin and vague. So just ask yourself a simple question. Which is more definitively observable to me, matter or the possibility there's a blob of spirit substance right here? No, I mean, spirit substance is so not observable, so not tangible, that until the fifth epical revelation, no one ever even thought of speaking of such things as spirit substance. Okay? I mean, that's just a reminder of how little personality viewpoint we have. All we really think of as solid is this stuff, which they tell you, if you had a real personality viewpoint, would be very shadowy. Okay? So, you know, right, there's very little personality that can be manifested in this life with this material identity. The moment that you have a Mirage identity, a whole bunch of spirit substance is visible to you. You're now personal like you weren't personal before. I mean, you can't see your guardian seraphim. You're not very personal yet. So personal that they're not even a vague shadowy thing. They're just not there at all. In most people's minds, they're fairy tales.
So when someone says make it personal, say, no way.
I'd love to take it personal, but I haven't gotten there yet. Yeah. I'm trying to think, but nothing happens, as the Three Stooges would say.
It seems like there's a lot of beauty in this thing about them appearing to be automatons. From our point of view, they might look automatic.
I mean, they're just so perfect. You know, what they need to do is just so perfectly known and executed, they just seem like a perfectly built machine. But no, they've looked at it, assessed it, made a decision, and done it.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Right. You know, we think that the sign of mind is goofs.
Is what?
When there's mistakes, you know.
Goofs.
You know, when there's goofs, when there's defects, you know, to err is human. You know, when you have expressions like that. Like, see, but you know, that's why you can be Lucifer and think that there's no God, because the action of his mind is so perfect, it's like the universe is just a machine without a God, even to a high being like Lucifer. Well, relatively high, obviously not very high, or he wouldn't have such a stupid thought in his head. But okay, but yeah, see, that's, you know, and so you know. Here you'd have the opposite challenge of, it's like, wow, I can actually see a being here. It's not like the universe, you know. I can see a being here. But that's not personal, huh? Wow, it's just like so coolly mindful. So you think about it, even though it's not a person brought it into being. See, the personality that you're wanting to give to it is not its. Whose personality is it that's being indirectly expressed there? The power centers. They're the persons that have been reproduced in impersonal form. So that's why it has that anthropomorphic quality to it, or anthropomorphizable quality to it.
Don't you think Lucifer was probably more ambitious than stupid?
Well, I was being facetious there. He wasn't stupid at all. He was so much more intelligent than any of us is, you know, we can't even imagine it. He was ignorant.
Ignorant.
He had one eye closed. Ignorant. Which eye? Did he have his material consciousness eye closed or his unity consciousness eye closed?
Unity.
He's a spirit being. A little hard to close your unity eye.
Individuality.
Yeah, he had his individuality eye closed. That's why he didn't have the depth perception. You know,
we have a phrase saying, "Too clever by half."
I mean, be thankful that it's hard for you to close your individuality eye, that you're so material to begin with, because the moment you start opening your spiritual eye, you're going to really like what you see. And but they've tried to give you some grace of having it be really hard to close your material, your individuality consciousness eye, so you don't so easily go astray. But Lucifer, you know, he can quickly lose sight of individuality. So he loses his depth perception. It takes depth perception to have the insight into the cosmos to know that there's a God there, not just things. That takes insight. See, he didn't have insight because he closed one eye. He has no depth perception. All right, it's the spirit eye that's dangerous. I just want to, you know, as long as you're just passing, you know, if you go up to, you don't have to go there. I'll just remind you. You know, if you go up to section 5 in the foreword, when they go body, mind, spirit, soul, remember that personality, Marantia, that little list. You know, mind, like so here, you're just thinking about your adjutant mind. They describe it as the thinking, perceiving, and feeling mechanism. Okay? It's just a mechanism. Your adjutant mind is just a mechanism. Generally, it's your associating mechanism. That's all it is. It's a fancy crescent wrench. It's an associating mechanism. Just like these mechanical beings are just that mechanism of mind. Okay? And they, see, that's why I'm saying this is talking about us. This is trying to help us understand us. Okay? So that you don't try to put all your eggs in the adjutant basket. There's a personalized self that at Sadr Court is going basically unnoticed by most humans. They know only the mechanism. They're kind of locked in themselves like these non-personal beings, these non-personal master physical controllers. You know, you need to break out of that prison. See it for the mechanism it is. Okay? Think about why do they call it adjutant mind? Okay? What does adjutant mean? Aid. Okay? You know, it means aid, A-I-D. You know, like an adjutant to a general. Okay? His aid. There's the personalized self in the upper domain of the hourglass. That's the real you. And then there's your aid. Your adjutant self, your aid self, your associating mechanism. You know, don't exalt its forms, its temperaments into you. Okay? It's a mortal self because it's a very limited usefulness associating mechanism. It dies and none of its temperaments or natures or anything is resurrected. It's all expendable. Okay? The real you is up here. Kind of parallel, okay? You know, so we're talking about two of these, you know, the associate power directors and the energy transformers are persons. They have an upper domain and a lower domain of the hourglass. The rest of them just have lower domains of the hourglass. They don't have an upper domain. The neck is pinched off. You know, there's no third level of meaning effectively, hey? Okay, they have no way, doorway up. Are confined to just a mechanism self. Okay. that is challenging to face. And that's why it's not just independent cosmic thinking, it's courageous. It takes courage to admit to yourself that you basically don't know much of anything about your real self, the thing that's going to be resurrected. Because you've gotten all delighted by the mechanism and the things it can do, thinking that's, you know, all there is and that's what's important. You know, so all those psychologists, you know, and whatnot that have dreamt up all, you know, religionists and whatnot who've dreamt up all kinds of fancy systems to describe the different aspects of that associating mechanism. Whatever. Okay? It's just a crescent wrench. I don't need to spend much time thinking about it. Okay, the real me is up here. It needs to reach down and start reforming that associating mechanism so it isn't just a victim of antecedent causation. You know, it isn't just what nature and nurture have dictated. It has some independence of decision forms in it. A form in it that people couldn't calculate at my conception. Because all those forms that are not coming down from above were calculable the moment I was conceived. Every kind of form that was going to, obviously it's trivial to calculate what the nature is going to teach it. Once I'm conceived, they know the nature. And they can calculate the system to, many decimal places. So they can predict almost every nurture thing that's going to make a form in there too. I'm just a mechanism.
For those of us in reawakening philosophy, this is assignment 6.
All right. I mean, and this is very important. It's very important. I mean, you're right up, as I pointed out, you're in the fifth section of the foreword, and they just called you a mechanism. Did you notice that? Or at least what you thought was you. They just threw it right out and see if you could handle it. Can you handle the rugged truth that everything that you hold dear right now is just a mechanism?
Other than your love.
That was just the mind, though, that they were
referring to. Right, but it's sad to record that so few persons know anything except their mindal self. Okay? And then on top of it, it's like, well, I'm gonna really try to be more of my personalized mind, my spiritualized mind, my personalized self. That's fantastic. That's what you should be doing. But remember, there's very little you can do here. You can cultivate it a lot. You can be a first circle. You can be right at the point of fusion. And you still can't see angels. Okay? There's very, it's a very minimal beginning. Because in this life, you perforce serve two masters. There's material gravity pulling you down. And you have no super absolute nature. No co-infinite nature that can overcome that material gravity of the aisle. And just suck the whole lower domain of the hourglass up into the upper domain. You can't do that. Bootstrap yourself up to full personal state.
But there lives within me one who can and will.
Yeah, right. And what little can be brought up, is going to nucleate about that adjuster. Now think how hard it is to do it when you didn't get an adjuster automatically, and you got to bootstrap yourself up there to get an adjuster. Thank God that it's post-Pentecost.
Yeah.
And you can be as dense as this and still get an adjuster.
Thank God.
Right. A nucleating agent up there, so that even if I don't have a lot of spirit gravity pulling up there, it just, the stuff that's up there sticks to it, like raindrops on a particle of dust, okay? All right. Like I said, there's no way we're going to get to Frandalex. Okay. All right. So don't ever forget that we're in a trilogy of papers here. The first paper is on power. Second paper is on, remember? What's paper 30 in this? Order. Power, order, ascension. Okay. There's so much more than fun little tidbits about physics here. Okay. This is step one in your ascension. Understanding where you're starting. You're starting where some beings are and stay. It's just a mechanism mostly. Okay, but you have the ability to begin to lift yourself up and being more than just an associating mechanism with a temperament, an associating mechanism that knows how to play the piano, say, or can do calculus or whatever.
So these non-personals, Is that what it ends up with them, is temperament?
Yeah, they just have a temperament.
Yeah. Fancy animals, then.
Yeah.
Well, they're not animal origin.
But they are, you know, they're like, you know, there are parallels. That's this whole point we're trying to point out. You know, what we have in animal origin added in mind, there is this very, very fancy parallel to it. That's below that personal plane. There's this whole vast space, and we're just in one part of that vast space. They're in that space too. Okay, let's keep going.
The physical controllers are chiefly occupied in the adjustment of basic energies undiscovered on Urantia. These unknown energies are very essential to the interplanetary system of transport and to certain techniques of communication. When we lay lines of energy for the purpose of conveying sound equivalents or of extending vision, these undiscovered forms of energy are utilized by the living physical controllers and their associates. These same energies are also, on occasion, used by the midway creatures in their routine work.
Oh, my goodness. How much stuff can we cram into one paragraph? Okay. All right. Like I said, we may burn up almost the next half hour and just on this one paragraph. Okay. This is a huge paragraph. There's all kinds of goodies here. Okay. Okay. So the physical controllers are chiefly occupied in the adjustment of basic energies undiscovered on Urantia. Okay. So I think a number of you know from, you know, studying more in the book, what the master physical controllers are basically working with is not energy that we can, you know, we immediately appreciate. It's sort of tangible energy. It's sub-electronic, as paper 42 calls it, for instance. Or if you want to think in an evolutional sense, pre-electronic. You know, as you're starting out with the force charge of space and working up, you know, to automatons and whatnot, and finally getting up to the electronic level where you have photons and neutrinos and electrons and protons and, you know, all those basic building blocks of the electronic level. We're talking below that, sub-electronic. Now, in terms of physics, so when you see basic energies undiscovered on Urantia, everyone who loves, you know, imagining they could build a, you know, an energy device that will save the energy, you know, solve the energy crisis or something like that. You know, love sentences like that. Okay, you gotta know. You know, the word energy, remember, has been generalized in the book. It doesn't just mean electronic level energy. You know, they even use it like spirit energy. Okay, they really generalize it. But an energy is a differential. So unlike a force that has no difference, it's the same everywhere, there's a differential to it so that, you know, it's something here and a different something there. So you can imagine two probes, you know, plugged into it that have a differential across it, like two poles of a battery, you know, and you can drop power some circuit or something, okay? But the energy we're talking about here, because it's sub-electronic, if you have any physics equation we have now that has a capital E in it for energy, for these energies, that E, that capital E, would be zero. Because that capital E is electronic level energy. So for all these energies, E equals zero. That's why we don't know about them, because especially, you know, once you get to the latter half of the 20th century, you had a lot of physicists basically believing that everything really, it's a universe of energy fundamentally, more than a universe of matter, and that the most fundamental thing is that capital E. So if capital E equals zero, that means there's nothing there. Okay? Literally, you know, that's their doctrine that, you know, that indicates the vacuum, okay, quote unquote, okay? Okay, so most of what drives the whole universe is considered nothing in physics right now, okay? It's not that it isn't discovered. It's an E, capital E, we haven't discovered yet. E equals some number. It's equals zero, so it's undiscoverable with our current assumption, and certainly with our current devices. All of our devices measure capital E equals something. They measure electronic level energy, charge, mass, whatever, you know, or something. That's all electronic level energy. Okay? an automaton and all the stuff between automatons and the electronic level don't have any of that stuff that we know about. Don't have any of those properties. Okay, so that's very important. And then, see, they point out these unknown energies are very essential to the interplanetary system of transport and certain techniques of communication. Okay, so remember, we mentioned that before. They put out these conduits of energy. And so on the master physical controller side, if we're thinking about them rather than the power centers, on the master physical controller side, you basically have this sub-electronic level energy that's laid out. And then who lays out that spirit energy in parallel to it? Andre can't answer this time. He did last week. Anyone remember? Who are those beings? Higher personalities in the infinite spirit that lay out the spirit energy in parallel to that. Circuit supervisors. Yep. Universe circuit supervisors.
I knew that.
Okay. Okay, so they lay out, so this sub-electronic level energy, see, then that's, oh, so it's a sub-electronic level energy that has an immediate relationship with spirit energy. Oh, that's interesting. So in other words, if I go down below the electronic level, the Earth, for instance, is going to have a substantiveness to it, to angels, say. You know, how does an angel stand on the Earth? Well, it's because it's not a purely spirit energy being to begin with. Okay, and then, but it's physical energy nature that's homogeneously blended in with the spirit energy, doesn't relate to the molecular level or even the atomic level or even the foundation of the electronic level. It finds resistance. Its feet, you know, are rested upon that sub-electronic level energy, which, like they're pointing out here, has a very immediate relationship with spirit energy. So much so that when you put the two next to each other, you get the super additive consequences of a mindal energy conduit between the two plates along this line, and they can conduct information along that mindal energy conduit. Okay, so see, they're
quarantine, the supervisors go away.
They're teaching you some things about, you know, how angels can dance on the head of the pin and that sort of stuff. You know, they're dealing with those mysteries of how, you know, if there's actually spirit beings, quote unquote, how do they relate to material things? It's like, well, they relate at a more fundamental level. I mean, because when you get all the way down to an automaton, for instance, now we're talking about something that even a transcendental being, an absonite being, can touch. You know, and his hand doesn't just pass through it. Okay, so, I mean, not only can high spirit beings find a footing, but even absonite beings can find footing if you sink down deep enough. Okay? All right? So you know, all these individualities are going to have relationship to energy, to individuality substance. Okay? So there's all that. But not the capital E in our physics equations, not electronic level energy. Their feet, you know, sink through that, if you will.
Which we have to kind of, in a way, imagine.
Right, but you can start to immediately observe it indirectly. If you just step back and relook at the experiments that we've done for the last 120 years, there are all kinds of almost direct evidence of this sub-electronic domain. Here, let me just throw out one. It's really simple. You don't even have to, you know, get into fancy things. You discover radioactivity. You discover that there's some atoms that seem to fall apart, that aren't stable. Okay? If you still believed in logic, unlike current scientists, if you still conformed your thoughts to logic, if you are watching a uranium atom, for instance, and it falls apart, you know that's an effect. that resulted from a cause. Okay? It's like, well, don't scientists think that? No. Scientists believe that uranium atoms fall apart for no cause, that there's a causeless effect. They believe that that radioactive decay, they call it, is magical, that it happens without a cause. Okay? It's like, well, how in the heck are they going to get anywhere in understanding radioactivity if they don't believe it's a causal phenomenon? Yeah, ding, 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 ding. That's why no one has gotten anywhere in understanding radioactivity. It's by definition in their doctrine impossible to understand because it's magical, it's causeless. You know, if you actually believed there was a cause to that effect that you're observing, you could maybe start to figure out how you could, you know, impact that causal relationship. It's like, well, we've carefully looked at that uranium atom. We've isolated it from everything. You know, we've looked at it, you know, with the biggest microscopes we have. There's nothing touching it. Nothing is causing it to fall apart. Yeah, well, nothing with electronic level energy. But the thing you can't see, the thing that you think is zero, electronic level energy equals zero, all of the sub-electronic level energy that you can't block by the walls that you build around your experiment, that atom is being pummeled by sub-electronic level energy. And in this environment, it's enough where it breaks the fragileness of a great big atom like uranium. The last atom that's small enough to hold itself together against the onslaught is which element? Element number 80? No, 8. It starts with a B. 83, it's bismuth. One after lead. You know, like Pepto-Bismol. Bismuth. Okay? right. 83 is the biggest one that'll hold itself together. Anything bigger than that, you know, the outer aspect of it, if you will, is too delicate in this environment. It gets broken. Okay, it doesn't decay magically. It's hit and broken. It's a cause and effect. It's causal. Okay? Again, there has to be energies that are not observed if you believe that the universe is logical, like we used to. But they don't believe that anymore. They think that things can be magical. Okay? Okay, that's a similar, you know, as soon as you bring in the sub-electronic, you know, if you have your logical eyes open as a scientist and you're reading this, you're going, oh my goodness, that's the answer to everything. No wonder I couldn't understand anything. I mean, it just opens the floodgates. You immediately can begin to construct a logical science again, a logical physics, instead of a magical one that actually has causality and locality and identity and et cetera.
Don't skirt around? Don't they figure out the probability of decay?
Right. So if you believe it's magical, therefore causeless and literally random, you'd start with that assumption. You write the equation down that describes that assumption, and you get the correct answer. You go, well, see, I've proved that my initial assumption that it's magical, random, is valid, because I get the correct answer when I assume that. No, you can rationalize anything. You can start with any initial assumption and get the correct answer. Okay? You just think that one's the correct one because it only took you 2 steps instead of 30 to get the correct answer. Okay? And you're not smart enough to do the one with 30 steps. But, you know, if someone was smarter, they could start with that random initial assumption. They could get the correct answer. No, I mean, it's you can assume it's random because the onslaught of that sub-electronic level energy is homogeneous and isotropic and intense. Okay? It's as if it's being assaulted, you know, by a magical randomness, see? And not, you know. That's why it's a valid assumption. Okay. However, if you start to study what things they've observed in the radioactive domain, you notice some things that if you weren't assuming it was causeless, would have caught your attention. Because you notice that when you change something, it seemed to change the rate of radioactive decay. Okay, but you believe that nothing can change it because it's causeless. So you just, you know, don't notice that really. You know, or brush it aside. You know, it's like, well, it's a statistical system, you know, and it's a statistical fluctuation. Yeah. No, you just notice something that you, a knob you can turn that'll alter radioactivity.
Yeah.
Imagine what that would do. If we actually knew how to turn knobs, you could, for instance, maybe solve the problem of radioactive waste.
Yeah, that's already, people are already looking at
it. If you knew a knob. But we believe there are no knobs. We believe it's magical, so no one's looking for a knob. That's why they're not finding the knob. Okay? There's countless examples of this in the history of science. You know, where they went for, you know, centuries at times not seeing something trivially demonstrable because no one ever tried to actually... It's like, well, if you plug those two things together, nothing happens, so don't even bother doing it. And so no one did for centuries. Because there's no curiosity. You have so little anti-blood. Everyone just was happy, just believing that nothing would happen. And then there, you know, some young whippersnapper who's a heretic, you know, waited till there's no one looking, and he stuck the two things together, and something happened. And we made an accidental discovery. Okay? I mean, we're in that mode again. We have just doctrine, you know. So, you know, there are no peoples... older than a certain age in the North Americas, and we've proven it. How have we proven it? Because when you're digging a hole, an archaeological dig, and you're digging a hole in North America, when you get down to that level, when you know you're at the earliest humans, you stop digging.
They just found those footprints.
If they would actually flip another shovel up, they'd find something. But no one's ever thought of flipping that shovel over in one foot deeper because they know there's nothing down there. That's why they haven't found anything older.
Dogma.
It's just dogma, doctrine.
So how does this go with the vision and the sound?
Okay. Okay, so that's the key. See, when you're thinking about vision and, okay, I actually see things or hear things in my mind, not in the matter of my eyeballs or my eardrums or whatnot. They aren't hearing or seeing anything. It's my mind that sees or hears. So that the forms that are sight, in, you know, the form, mindal forms that are sight or sound, they can send those mindal forms down that mindal energy conduit in between the two plates of physical and spiritual energy. They literally, you know, that's how they communicate is mindally. So they just build an extension to their associating mechanism, a literal conduit of mindal energy that connects two associating mechanisms together.
They talk about, was that Adam and Eve?
Right, all that sort of stuff, you know. But you know, even beyond them, I mean, just everyone in the universe is interacting mindily. It's only us that has to jiggle air molecules, okay? I mean, everyone is interacting mindily, okay? And so,
That's comforting. And
they're all content with the fact that what's actually seeing and hearing stuff is their associating mechanism. Now, what's interpreting, okay, that's their personal self, but what's literally, you know, has those sight or sound forms in it is their associating mechanism, and they connect two associating mechanisms by a mindal energy conduit so they can get those forms from one associating mechanism to the other. That's all they do. Okay, all they do. But, you know, it's technically, it's pretty straightforward, you know, to understand what they're doing, even if you can't get into all the details.
So they peel off the circuit supervisors for quarantine
purposes. Right, and so like they said, when you read about the circuit, you know, that's, you know, if you pull the top plate off, then there's no super additive consequence, there's no mindal conduit, and you can still have that sub-electronic level energy line. Okay, in line. I mean, this is, the first time I read this, I just chuckled. I mean, because if anyone, especially in the, I think it was starting in like 69 or something like that, the notion of ley lines, L-E-Y, instead of L-A-Y, L-E-Y lines, ley lines, became a fascination and amongst spiritual, mystical circles. An idea that was It started back in the early part of the 20th century, got picked up by the mystics, and was, they were running with it. But right here, they're saying, you know that notion that you have that there may be some kind of like special lines on the planet, even before you've gone all mystical with them? There might be special lines. Well, guess what there are? The massive physical controllers on the planet form node points, and they actually establish one of these lines of energy between those two node points. There are literally lines of energy that they lay out, L-A-Y, that, in other words, there's a truth to that notion you have. There actually are genuine ley lines, not your magical, mystical ones. Yeah. So that they love to do that. They love to take some little idea we have and say, you know that thing that most of you who think are sane have dismissed as foolishness? Well, there's actually a little thread of truth in that. There actually are lines of energy. It's a sub-electronic level energy, though, so don't expect to
light a fluorescent tube.
Yeah, or to feel it, in any definitive way. But you may have mythology coming down from ancient times when someone at some point, like a rebel midway or something, or maybe even the prince's staff or someone, told you about these things. And you've always been fascinated by the notion that there's these kind of magical lines on the planet and, kind of connecting the unseen beings together and stuff.
Yeah, what if you take a caterpillar tractor and cut through it?
Then what? Okay. Yeah. So anyway, they're playing with it there. They could have said that so many ways, but they purposely said, we lay lines of energy.
Chris?
Yep.
Been people among the Aboriginals in Australia who have been able to communicate in a way that other people cannot understand.
Right. There are some fringe things that might not be totally delusional. And you see, that's what these sorts of things bring in. They're saying, it might not all be, foolishness. There's actually some literal things, and especially since you're an experimental world and you didn't get the proper biologic uplift or blending and everything, there's some people on this planet that are kind of way off on the fringes of the mind that you're supposed to have. So there could be people that could have some sensitivities to some of these subtle things. That's what's between the lines of a statement like that. It's like, maybe there might be some people that just for some reason, I think this spot on the planet is different than other spots. Well, how? Well, I don't know. It just, there's some subtle thing. I think this is a special spot. It may actually be. It may not be delusion. It may actually be where a master physical controller stands all the time, in this energy grid. And we build temples there and stuff.
There's an archangel.
Right, there's an archangel everywhere and all these sorts of things too, yeah. All right, so, they just open these, these interesting cans of worms, when they say things like that. And then the other thing, I guess, is really cool. These same energies are also on occasion used by the midway creatures in their routine work. Chris may remember that very recently we were just talking about this, making some kind of ahas. Okay, here's where they're wanting you to put a couple things together. You combine this statement, with another statement that reinforces it. When they say that these energies, so sub-electronic level energies, okay, occasionally used by the midway creatures, you don't have to turn to it, but up in the midway creature paper, it says that... I don't know what paper is that. 77, section 8, there's this little statement. It's about the secondary midwayers. These unique creatures have certain definite powers over the things of time and space. That's basically what they're saying here too. Okay, and they're giving you a little bit more tech. You know, it's how do they have that?
Right.
They engage it at a sub-electronic level. At a level where if they're doing that, we won't see their hands or anything. You know, they can make themselves visible where and grab things like we do. You know, pick this cup up and I can see their hand and everything. But they could stay invisible and grab it sub-electronically and move it. And then I would think this cup is magically floating around. Okay? Like writing on the wall and, you know, and Daniel and things like that. Okay? Okay. Now, think about how this works. To understand a little bit better where the midwayers fit into the picture. You know very definitively several places in black and white in the book when they're talking about the hierarchy of angels, because they can't talk about that lower order of angels below the cherubim. You know, that's, they couldn't reveal that. They just allude to it a couple times. Instead of you know, you have this hierarchy list of the angels, and then they stick the midwayers down at the bottom in the place of those unrevealed angels. Because they say, well, basically, the midwayers are like, you know, a lower order of angels. Okay? And they are. They're parallel. They're at that level, down there at the bottom, basically, of the hierarchy, but not literally in that line, that descending line. They're parallel to it. Okay? So, in that sense, when you have the cosmic mothers, you have the mothers of daughters of angels, and you have that hierarchy coming down. You know, like created mother spirits have seraphim. You know, that hierarchy of personal ministry, you know, beings that are personal ministers, angels, that's coming down from the aspect of the third source and center. It's called the infinite mother spirit. The top of the mother downreach and all the personal ministry that comes down from it. So right there, you know, when they talk about the angels and the midwayers in relationship, they're reminding you that the midwayers you don't know at that point, but what they actually have is one side of them that's kind of angel-like, personal ministry-like. Well, the third source and center is not just the infinite mother spirit putting a downreach. It's also just the infinite spirit. So there's the she and there's the it, the infinite spirit. You know, that non-personal expression or face, if you will, of the third source and center. These power beings we're reading about, they're in that hierarchy. You know, we're reading about master physical controllers and, you know, et cetera, centers and directors. Okay, they're coming down from the infinite spirit. Look what they just did. They said that there's another half of those midwares that is, you know, down there with the master physical controllers like them. Okay? The lower realms, obviously, of the master physical controllers, but they're like them a little bit. So they're like the lowest angels a little bit, and they're like the lowest aspects of the master physical controllers a little bit. It's almost like they're a power, personality, synthesis. Okay. What the midwayers represent, see, both, whether you think of the downreach of the infinite spirit or the infinite mother spirit, you know, you're coming down as from the existential, from paradise down to us. You know, it's more directly tied to existential deity, even though mother's experience, you know, but it's rooted in that existential paradise source and center phenomenon. But there's not just existential deity downreaching. There's also experiential deity, like the Supreme, which is slowly coalescing and welling up. Eventually, it's all going to coalesce and well all the way up to the total power personality synthesis of the Supreme Being. But on the way up, you get little measures of power personality synthesis welling up, like a midwayer. A midwayer is an expression of the experiential, or experiential deity rather than the existential deity, coalescing and welling up into existence. And it's going to have two sides to it. Personality side and a power side. Because they're a power-personality synthesis. Okay? And you go, well, wait, I mean, like, they just, you know, zeroing in on secondary midwayers even specifically. And those are like grandchildren of Adamson and Rada.
Yeah.
So they're not that different from me.
No.
Well, yes, but not, I mean, they're not as different from me as a divine counselor is different from me or something, or a Frandalank. Okay, remember what we discovered as we were going through the previous papers. Oh, really, bottom line, we're Trinity origin beings. Where does the personal spirit nature of the Supreme Being come from? From the Paradise Trinity. Okay. I mean, we're not Trinity origin beings in the sense that Ancients of Days are Trinity origin beings. We're not an existential Trinity origin being, but we're an experiential Trinity origin being. And that's why when we're a finality, we take an oath to the Paradise Trinity. Because that's who we're related to. The Paradise Trinity, but via the experiential deity path, really the mother path, rather than the father-dominated path. Okay? So that's why. See, so if once you recognize that you know, you're seeing experiential deity and a power personality synthesis coming up, and they're not that removed from us, and they have certain powers. Like I was saying, because humans haven't been localized like they were supposed to, because of the rebellion and the fall, and we started out as an experimental world to start with, and so we weren't as localized to begin with, there could be humans who have shades of this, shades of the manifestation of power personality synthesis that they really shouldn't have. We'd gotten confined to like Grace, but of doing whatever. So again, there's a whole bunch of that stuff, you know, could certainly be just drivel. But see, they're doing it again. It's like, you know, be really careful though, they're saying, about just whole scale dismissing all that stuff. There may be some shades of valid fact there. I mean, after all, you know, you have, you know, these savant individuals who can do mathematics like seraphim do. So you don't have to vary a human too much and they can start to have mind seated on them, not that different from the mathematical geniuses of the seraphim, you know. Or you can do the Rain Man thing, pour the matches out on the floor, and you don't have to count the matches. You just look at it and know how many matches are. They don't count the number of hairs on your head. They just look at you and know how many hairs you have. Holistically, okay? Mother-like, not, you know, father-like. Father-like is counting them. Mother-like is holistic. It just knows them all simultaneously. The father can only know one thing at a time, so it has to count them. One, two, three, four. Okay? The mother knows it every hair simultaneously. You know, more mother-like, seraphim mind, like Rain Man, just knows how many matches there are there all at once, because he has a holistic relationship. So, see, I mean, we have all kinds of evidence that you can shove human mind over a little bit into some of these nooks, and you start to get things that are kind of midware-like or seraphim-like or who knows what-like. You're kind of getting off in the fringes of where we're supposed to be. All right, so, like I said, see, in, you know, we could obviously talk for ages about that. And the fact that it's 9:25 right now, let's not even go into the associate power director. Let's just stop there, and we'll pick it up there. If someone has a little quick question, we could address that before we wrap it up. Is there something anyone wanted to follow up with all that? Anything on gravity or anything like that that you might want to tease out a little bit more before we wrap it up?
We talked about the term subatomic.
Yeah. Okay.
For us who got seventh grade science in the background, so to speak. Can you be a little more explicit on, give us an example of what might be subatomic? How can we?
Okay, now you're thinking sub-electronic, like I've been saying?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been saying sub-electronic or subatomic?
I've been saying sub-electronic.
Okay. Some sort of other force that's sub-e.
Okay.
I get you. Scientists don't even believe that exists, right?
Right. I mean,
meaning pre-E?
Magical notions of string theory and quarks and all that sort of stuff, that's all capital E, not equal to zero. That's electronic level. See, like they're trying to figure out what the origin of mass is. Okay, mass comes from the sub-electronic, you know, the absinthe, even you could say, up into the finite. That's the actual source of mass. It comes from below equals zero, up to equal zero, and up into E greater than zero. That's the actual source of mass.
Does sub mean prior to? Or?
Yeah, like I said, instead of saying sub-electronic, you could say pre-electronic, if you were thinking, starting with primordial force, going to automatons.
Okay. Does it come out of primordial force?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Right. Right. Think about how totally turned around current science is. You know, they're building all these massive accelerators and all this, and looking for the God particle and all this sort of stuff that they think is going to rationalize mass. Explain to them where mass comes from. Where are they looking for the answer? Are they looking down there around equals zero where it's bubbling up from?
No.
They're trying to go up to the biggest E that we can make.
Way exciting.
E equals near infinity. That's where they're looking for the answer. The absolute opposite direction. The bigger the accelerator they build, the farther they're getting away from the answer.
Wow.
Okay. But it gets rid of, you know,
eventually they're going to go the other way because they're going to
get, you know, superfluous billions of dollars get spent.
Yeah. They have money and they all have
You know, and you get all these really cool pictures of these gigantic, complicated gizmo bobs, you know. Okay. Right. But see, you know, it's below. You know, it's at E less than zero, quote unquote. You know, it's actually, see, what you need, you know, there is no capital E less than zero, technically. I mean, what you need is a better E than the E, you know. You need a generalized energy like the relatives are bringing in. You need to recognize that differential energy isn't just electronic level differentials. There's subtler differentials. And it's like, well, how do you know? It's like, well, think logically about the experiments that you've done for the last, you know, since just before the beginning of the 20th century. Think about them logically. They're trying to tell you some things that you're ignoring.
But as far as history goes, we've just recently discovered electrons, so to speak.
Right, you know, like I said, just immediately before the beginning of the 20th century, we discovered the electron.
You know, as far as time is concerned, it just was a second ago.
Yeah, right. Right, so, but the last 100 years could have been huge if we hadn't given up logic in the 20s, basically. And actually, we actually started giving up in the middle of the 19th century, but, you know, we sort of whole-scale giving up on a logical universe. And by the time you get to the revelation being basically in place, the emergency behind why this thing is in my lap was in play. We were letting go of a logical physical theory. We were just, you know, allowing the initial assumptions to be whatever pleased you. Whatever pleased your associating mechanism, that was a beginning assumption. Your associating mechanism doesn't know logic. Only the upper domain of the hourglass can discriminate between fact and figment, right and wrong. You know, et cetera. The first level is causal, the causality level. Now, we let go of that. We stop believing in what is self-evident. We stop believing in common sense. When you hear me say positivism, the reason I bring that up is its most core tenet is the rejection of common sense, the rejection of intuition, the rejection of insight, that nothing can be self-evident. There is no logic. It's just wishful thinking and delusion and the bias of your experiences. And so, you know, we gave up on causality. We gave up on the law of identity. So now something can be a wave and a particle at the same time. No, it can't. That's illogical. It has to be one or the other. It can't be both. You know, you can't be a cat and a human at the same time. You got to be one or the other.
Unless you're
Hermione. Right, well, that's what I point out. See, you hit it right there.
Yeah.
You know, you all know that's what I bring up, right? Right.
What did he say?
The three fundamental assumptions of current science are the three fundamental assumptions of magic that J.K. Rowling uses. Right. She can't have the law of causality and identity and locality bothering her, at least to it, you know, not fully. You know, think about, and we got rid of most of the law of locality, and I was just, someone recently sent me an article that they thought looked really interesting, so I looked at it, and these scientists are, well, they're not, they're theoreticians, are really excited, because they're pretty sure they figured out how to get rid of the last shred of the law of locality. The idea that you could, that the law of locality, that I have to be here or there, I can't be both, right? And then on top of that, they said not only that you can get rid of the last shred of the law of locality, that last bit of foolish delusion that we have and primitive thought, we're now free thinkers, but we can even get rid of the law that says that the probabilities have to add up to 100%. We can even get rid of that one. So now they can just add up to whatever is convenient to get the right answer. It's a brave new world, okay? I mean, this is, like I said, we're descending rapidly, you know? If the one handhold we had on reality in the scientific domain lets go of reality, do you think religion is going to take up the slack and grab a hold of reality? I don't think so. And if neither of them are holding on to reality, is there any super additive consequence of a philosophic, wise, logical, you know, human that can have a civilization? No. It's an emergency. our one little fingernail hold on reality is slipping rapidly. So now you don't even need unitarity. Yeah. So that it has to add up to 100%.
Subatomic for just 1 second.
Sub-electronic.
So to be able, so let's say we get turn science around and they recognize subelectronic and begin to work on it. Mm-hmm. Where does it go? Or where can it go?
It'll quickly go to actually knowing what mass and charge and, you know, what electricity and magnetism and gravity are. Anti-gravity. Will probably fall out pretty quickly. That'll revolutionize civilization.
Transmutation.
I mean, like I said, I mean, you know, you can.
Physical.
What if you can control radioactivity?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. There's all these things. I mean, if charge and mass weren't words, if you could derive them, I mean, everything. You know, you'd suddenly have a science again.
Yeah. Scientifically, right? But then. And you were talking earlier about the duality or the way they work together with spirituality. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, because there's two sides to this. You know, they talk a little bit in the book about how the spirituality of the world is not catching up to the, you know, the intellectuality or the science.
And sad to record that Sophie Bell. Right. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean.
You know, is this the kind of thing they talk about when they say, well, then I know you've got to go. But, you know, man will think he's found God when he finds this atomic
cohesive
integrity type thing?
The way this will go beyond science is what I was just alluding to. You know, if you bring in what you're saying, if you get a measure of true science again, in a more modern man, it will encourage some of those modern men to begin to take hold of a true religion. Okay? You sort of are reminded that it has to be true or it's delusion, okay? You'll let go, you know, if you let go of a superstitious science, you might have a chance of letting go of a superstitious religion. But you're never going to let go of a superstitious religion if you're holding on to a superstitious science, is what we have now. You know, believing in black holes and dark energy and all these, you know, silly things. But so if you do that, if you get true science and true religion in the inner life of a human, he can become a philosophic man. Now, remember, it even says in paper 140 that Jesus didn't come here to establish a merely religious man. But it doesn't say the rest of the sentence. wants you to fill in the blank. What did he come here to do then? If he didn't come here to merely establish a religious man, what did he come here to do? He came here to establish a philosophic man. If you begin with religion, that's the spark. You can combine that with the science that he knew would be coming soon. And you can have a philosophic man. You can have a man who can have advancing civilization. You have a man that can solve all of our economic and governmental and social and political problems because he will have a big picture mind instead of just dueling dichotomies down in Flatland. There will be a super additive consequence and everything will change. That kind of man is soil for a philosophic uplifter, for a magisterial son. But there is no such soil. There is going to be no such son in the near future. You know, any more than Jesus could have been if Machiavelli and crew hadn't made sure that there was spiritual soil that he could uplift. Yeah. Instead of the magisterial son coming, you know, say 200 years from now or something, maybe if you really, you know, put it on the aggressive side, you know, maybe there's going to be 2,000 years of dark ages. Okay, and you can forget about technology revolutionizing the world, and we'll have to all need sharp battle axes. That's all there will be to life. So it's a dark picture that they paint. Yeah. They say point blank several spots in the book that if you keep this up, you will have to go back to the primitive usages. Wow. Yeah, in order to have any order. So, all right. We'll get to order next paper. We'll pick up the rest of the power here next time. Let's take a moment here.